Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
It's a great pleasure for me to introduce the next speaker, Dr. Katie Kelly, who has graciously accepted our invitation to be the guest faculty for this conference. As you're all aware, hepatocellular carcinoma is an extremely complex disease and requires a multidisciplinary approach to the management. Every week we review about 40 cases of HCC in our tumor board, and so the efforts has to be integrated from different specialties, including hepatology, surgery, oncology, radiology, interventional radiology. And Katie is really leading the oncologic efforts and has been fantastic collaborating with Katie both in research areas as well as in patient care. I really look forward to a great talk on hepatocellular carcinoma, molecular approach to treatment. We are in the dawn of a new era with these new adjuvant therapies, so it's an extremely important topic. Thank you very much, Dr. Kelly, for coming.
So thank you very, very much for having me. I would like to present an update from the medical oncology perspective on recent advances in systemic therapy for HCC, which largely derive from an improved understanding of molecular targets in this complex and historically treatment-refractory disease. Now, most of what I'm going to be talking about pertains to data from the advanced disease setting, but it is certainly to be hoped for that these findings will soon translate to improved options for patients with high risk for recurrence after local regional therapies, such as or surgery or transplant. So the objectives are to first review the role of sorafenib in advanced HCC, including patient selection, toxicity, outcomes, and dosing, and then provide an overview of emerging studies of novel targeted therapies and combination therapies under study in advanced HCC, as well as adjuvants to local regional therapy and surgery. And finally, to touch upon emerging data for the importance of molecular subclassification in HCC. So all of you are probably familiar with the BCLC cancer staging schema, and the circled areas here are the patients that I generally see in clinic, patients with advanced disease and adequate liver function to consider systemic therapy. Now, with improving therapies, these circles may eventually move to the left somewhat and include patients with intermediate stage disease, high risk for recurrence. Before proceeding further, I think it's very important to preface this talk with an overview of the challenges that have historically faced systemic therapy in HCC, which are many, as you all know. On the patient side of things, there's the huge underlying problem of cirrhosis as a competing cause of morbidity and mortality, as well as a factor which significantly increases the toxicity of systemic therapies due to differences in metabolism, and that's, of course, present in at least 80 to 90% of patients with HCC. There's also inherent chemo resistance in hepatoma cells because of increased multi-drug resistance genes expression, as well as the presence of drug efflux pumps. On the clinical research side, there are also several unique challenges. One is identifying active drugs by radiographic response, which is the traditional way of doing it in oncology, because in the inelastic cirrhotic liver, tumors don't shrink. You can't measure a size difference very, very well, and so it's harder to quantify something more qualitative like tumor necrosis and on a large-scale study identify an active agent. There's also a high degree of molecular heterogeneity, which I'll come back to at multiple points throughout this talk. And then finally, there's a great lack of tissue for oncology research purposes and drug development, and that's because of the validation of radiographic diagnosis in this disease. Many patients never get biopsied, which is probably the only tumor type for which this is true. So, again, referring back to the historical challenges in HCC systemic therapy, there have been many, many trials of single agents and combination chemotherapies with all relatively abysmal response rates and very poor median survival. And this is true in combination studies as well as single agent studies. And suffice it to say, none of them have shown a survival advantage when done in a randomized setting. So in light of the very poor outcomes of HCC systemic therapy, it has always been a great need area in oncology. With the advent of molecularly targeted therapies in other tumor types, the relevant important key pathways in HCC carcinogenesis have again come under scrutiny, and this slide is a depiction of some of the more important families of genes. So we see one big category are the receptor tyrosine kinases and growth factor pathways, as well as the Wnt pathway, and then a host of intracellular signaling molecules, which as a whole, I would say, represent druggable targets in at least half of the cases based on what's in the preclinical study and in clinical trials at this point. So sorafenib is a multi-kinase inhibitor, which was approved for renal cell carcinoma about 5 years ago, which targets both the RAF kinase and, through the RAF kinase, the MEK and MAP kinase pathways, and vascular endothelial growth factor receptor isoforms 2 and 3 predominantly, and the platelet-derived growth factor receptor beta, PDGFR receptor. Based on the preclinical rationale for sorafenib in HCC as well as phase 2 data, the randomized, multi-center, multinational, placebo-controlled phase 3 trial that we all know as SHARP came to be. This is a schema for the SHARP trial and showing some critical points, which is that it required child PUA liver function for eligibility and randomized patients to placebo or sorafenib continuous dosing. This was conducted in Western centers across the world, but largely in Europe and the United States. So again, to highlight the key demographic points in the Western population, this is about 30% of patients had hepatitis C. Globally speaking, hepatitis B was very underrepresented with about 20% because of the Western population. Very fit patients with ECOG performance score of 0 to 1 in the vast majority. And again, because of its eligibility criteria, almost all patients were child PUA. The majority were BCLC-C, advanced stage disease. So here is the survival curve that shows the first drug to prolong survival in a randomized study in HCC compared to placebo. While it's not a home run, the median overall survival in the advanced setting, the median overall survival in the sorafenib arm is 10.7 months compared to placebo, which was 7.9 months, and overall this was highly statistically significant. The results held true in all of the pre-planned subsets, including patients with extrahepatic disease and vascular invasion. And as a quick overview of toxicity, the majority of toxicity in this study actually fell into the category what I would consider a nuisance-type toxicity rather than significant life-threatening toxicity. So we have diarrhea, hand-foot syndrome, and anorexia. But it was overall very well tolerated in this study. However, in parallel, Bayer Onyx sponsored an identical trial in Asia called the Asia-Pacific Study of sorafenib. And you'll see that the curves look quite similar compared to the SHARP study. And this is very interesting because if you actually look at the numbers, the overall survival is much lower. The overall survival for the sorafenib arm is 6.5 months compared to the placebo arm of 4.2 months. While the hazard ratio is the same. So to summarize this, the patients in this study derived the same degree of benefit but had much worse outcomes by comparison to the Western population of the SHARP study. And as you might expect from an Asian-predominant study, about 70% of the patients in this study had hepatitis B-related HCC. And this harkens to the great clinical heterogeneity in HCC as a tumor type, which probably impacts greatly upon its response to specific therapies. Now, what about another very important subset of patients, the non-child PUA class cirrhosis? In the SHARP study, the vast majority, as well as the Asia-Pacific study, which had identical eligibility criteria, the patients were largely child PUA cirrhotics. A phase 2 study leading into SHARP had about 30% patients with child PUB cirrhosis, so about 38 patients. And you can see here that there's a dramatic difference in the tolerability, the length of time on drug in child PUA versus child PUB in this phase 2 study that led into SHARP. And there was also a much shorter time to progression and a dramatically shorter overall survival, 41 weeks versus 14 weeks, again, in this preceding phase 2 study. In the same study, they showed a significantly higher rate of serious adverse events and hepatic decompensation in the child PUB patients. In the non-randomized setting, it's impossible to determine whether this is because of sorafenib or a causal effect from the drug, versus a bystander effect of being a child pubis cirrhotic. The concern about underlying liver dysfunction and tolerability of sorafenib prompted an organ dysfunction study from the cooperative group CLGB 60301, which was published about 2 years ago, and stratified patients into four different subsets of liver dysfunction based on the NCI organ dysfunction working criteria, ODWG, I believe, organ dysfunction working group criteria, and basically came up with different dosing that was tolerable according to your baseline liver function. This is in the handouts. The big picture is that patients with very mild dysfunction and child PUA cirrhosis do tolerate the doses of the SHARP study, 400 milligrams twice daily, but that in patients with severe dysfunction with classified by bilirubin 3 to 10 times upper limit of normal, they did not identify a safe dose of sorafenib, and likewise patients with low albumin only tolerated 200 milligrams once daily, significantly less than those with child PUA liver function. Now, to great credit, Bayer Onyx, in parallel with their work in the SHARP study, actually following upon their work with the SHARP study and the Asia-Pacific study, sponsored a global registry study entitled Gideon, which accrued about 3,000 patients worldwide to look at real-world outcomes with the use of sorafenib. This is, again, based upon the fact that we see that child PUB patients do significantly worse, hepatitis B patients do significantly worse. How does this drug perform in all comers, not the highly selected SHARP population? And we see interesting findings that here the median duration of treatment in the child PUA arm was about 14 weeks, and this degraded significantly when you look at the very few patients with child PUC who were started on sorafenib in the study, only about 4 weeks, due to a combination of tolerability, hepatic dysfunction, and tumor progression. And here we see the survival curves associated with each class of liver dysfunction. So I'll take a moment to pause here to summarize the findings about sorafenib. I would say that certainly the SHARP study deserves its place as a landmark study in HCC for being the first study to show in a randomized setting a survival benefit in this very complex and historically treatment refractory disease, and it has changed practice patterns world round. It's another really interesting point to credit the SHARP study with is that it has reawakened the interest of the drug development community in hepatocellular carcinoma. Now, up until this study, I think HCC was somewhat considered the proverbial third rail of drug development. Touch it and your drug is dead because of the challenges of studying this patient population. And here is a study that shows that one can actually achieve a survival benefit in these patients. However, there are certain challenges that cannot be overlooked, which is certainly the heterogeneous degree of benefit based on liver dysfunction, noting that the majority of patients are not very fit child PUA. Its differential benefit in hepatitis B patients, which comprise the majority of patients with this disease, and its overall poor tolerability when used in a real-world setting, noting very short time on drug. Oh, and I should add a fourth major caveat is it's very modest efficacy. We clearly need better drugs. With a median survival of 10.7 months in the advanced setting, it's inadequate, and there's much work to be done. This remains an area of great need in oncology. So that brings us to part two, which is what are the treatment options beyond sorafenib? And at present, there really are no standard of care treatment options. Sorafenib is the only drug with FDA labeling for hepatocellular carcinoma in the advanced setting. And here are the NCCN guidelines for metastatic and advanced hepatocellular carcinoma with options after sorafenib, including supportive care or clinical trial participation. Now, this is hard to see. I apologize for the fine print, but I wanted to give a sense of the scope of drug development, which has been incited by the SHARP study, with now a host of randomized phase 3 studies on the horizon and actually nearing accrual. These are the randomized phase 3 studies for advanced hepatocellular carcinoma that are referenced by the National Cancer Institute and available on clinicaltrials.gov, and you'll see that there are dramatically more than there have been in years past. So I'll touch upon a couple of the novel drugs coming up. Brivinib is a Bristol-Myers Squibb drug that targets VEGFR2 as well as fibroblast growth factor and is being studied randomized phase 3 study head-to-head with sorafenib as well as in the second-line setting compared to placebo or best supportive care. Lenifenib is an Abbott drug, which targets VEGF receptor isoforms as well as PDGFR and is also being compared in head-to-head with sorafenib in the first-line setting for advanced HCC. There are multiple studies which have looked at bevacizumab as a single agent or in combination. The most provocative of these is the combination with Tarceva or erlotinib, a drug that's used in lung cancer as well as pancreas cancer, and has shown in the phase 2 setting a median overall survival of, 62 weeks at present. Almost a year and a half. Now, lest there be any undue exuberance and to satisfy those skeptics out there that how can there be multiple drugs approved in a short period of time for a disease as difficult as HCC. The first of these studies to reach maturity is the sunitinib versus sorafenib in advanced HCC, and it was actually closed early due to lack of efficacy and toxicity. So all is not solved with the advent of molecular therapy. Another study that's worth noting in the intergroup setting, which is being done in cooperative groups across the through the cooperative groups across the country, is a novel combination of an old drug, doxorubicin, with sorafenib, based on the preclinical rationale that if you add sorafenib to target RAF1, stress mechanisms incited by cytotoxic chemotherapy and doxorubicin may be affect an increased degree of apoptosis. This is supported by their provocative phase 2 results showing a median overall survival of greater than 14 months. Of course, randomized data from the ongoing phase 3 study will be required to confirm this. Another provocative combination, as I mentioned, is the Avastin plus Tarceva or bevacizumab or erlotinib to use generics, which is ongoing. So the question emerges with these molecular targeted therapies, is there a role for these in earlier stage disease? And this table highlights some of the ongoing studies looking at the use of multi-kinase inhibitors, brivinib, sorafenib, sunitinib, and then the old-fashioned anti-angiogenic agent thalidomide after local regional therapy such as chemoembolization or radiofrequency ablation or after surgery. So starting with the role of adjuvant therapy after embolization, type approaches, there's great data that embolization itself increases angiogenesis. This is a mouse model of transarterial embolization, which shows increased microvessel density and neoangiogenesis based on CD31 staining in mouse liver, as well as a rise in VEGF levels, which occurs predictably after embolization is performed. This has also been shown in multiple other animal models and in humans that VEGF levels and circulating angiogenesis markers increase after embolization approaches. So the rationale arises, would combining an anti-angiogenic agent with embolization approaches improve the efficacy and decrease local recurrence rates or new tumor formation? And so that has prompted multiple ongoing studies. This is the first to be completed, the post-haste Asian study, which was performed in Japan and Korea, and unfortunately turned out to be a negative study. They did not show a survival benefit. Didn't show up here for the TACE placebo arm was about 29 months, and they did not reach their survival endpoint due to statistical reasons and censoring in the treatment arm. And there was not a statistical difference in time to progression in either arm. The study is criticized, however, because the drug was started 1 to 3 months after embolization in this study, which perhaps is missing the window of opportunity to affect a benefit in decreasing angiogenesis. Here in the United States, we're conducting the ECOG randomized phase 3 study comparing chemoembolization alone to chemoembolization plus sorafenib as a means to decrease recurrence risk in patients with unresectable, untransplantable, localized hepatocellular carcinoma. This study has been accruing very poorly, however, and one of the reasons for that perhaps is the wide use of sorafenib in the community without being on a trial in this setting. Another important study that should reach maturity very soon is the STORM trial, looking at the post-surgical use of sorafenib in high-risk patients, for example, those who are found to have microvessel invasion or satellite nodules, to reduce recurrence risk after surgery. And that study has accrued, and mature results should be available within the next year. So I will also end with a discussion of some of the clinical trials we have available at UCSF for patients with HCC. In the intermediate stage patients, we have opened the ECOG 1208 study comparing chemoembolization alone plus sorafenib. We also have the aforementioned CLGB 80802 study, which compares sorafenib with or without doxorubicin as first-line therapy for patients with advanced disease. We have a phase 1-2 trial looking at sorafenib plus temsirolimus that is currently in the phase 2 stage of the study. We have an oral transforming growth factor beta receptor 1 inhibitor as a second-line therapy or for sorafenib-ineligible patients, as well as a dual TORC 1-2 inhibitor from Celgene for patients with any prior therapy. And finally, we recently closed a study of a novel VEGFR2/MET inhibitor called cabozantinib, which is a very exciting drug. I'll show you some additional images in a moment. And finally, we're trying to make an effort to catalog tissue and blood samples and generate a biorepository in the future. Now, I'd like to make a quick point that many, with the advent of these molecular therapies and a burgeoning set of clinical trials for HCC, tissue confirmation is often required. While it's not required clinically to diagnose HCC, it is required for enrollment on many clinical trials. And so I would entreat you to think about when patients are undergoing a radiofrequency ablation or other surgical procedure where tissue would be easy to acquire without additional risk. There's a new reason to consider getting a biopsy for patients in HCC. Oh, shoot, I was going to end with a very provocative slide of some of our responses that we've seen in the in our study of temsirolimus plus sorafenib, temsirolimus being an mTOR inhibitor, but unfortunately, you'll have to imagine it being just very dramatic. But in fact, it is. So actually, if you look in the handout, I would like you to take a look, because we have patients who have been on for the longest, at this point, 16 months and rolling. I saw the patient yesterday, and we have somebody who has had biopsy-proven bilateral pulmonary metastases and a very bulky... Oops, here we go. Sorry about that. Bulky primary tumor, who has had a very dramatic response with disappearance of the pulmonary metastases and a significant shrinkage in several of his liver, actually all of his multiple liver lesions after 16 months without significant toxicity, corroborated by an AFP response. And again, this is biopsy-proven disease. Another promising study that we were a part of and one of the lead accruers to was a dual c-MET and VEGF inhibitor in advanced HCC patients, which has shown a dramatic response rate for HCC, not for, say, breast cancer, but certainly very provocative in this tumor type, as well as prolonged durable responses to therapy, all of which are highly encouraging and certainly provocative to continue the efforts to identify patient subsets who will respond to molecularly targeted treatments. Lastly, this is the last slide. I wanted to identify sort of some general molecular subsets that are emerging with the availability of novel techniques to perform gene expression profiling and identify reproducible subsets of patients with clinically relevant characteristics. For example, gene expression profiles that seem to consistently identify more aggressive behaving HCC that corresponds as well to specific mutations and, for example, P53 and clinical features such as high AFP expression by comparison to signatures and other mutations like beta-catenin that seem to correlate with a less aggressive HCC subtype. And I think ultimately from the medical oncology perspective, from someone who treats advanced disease patients, I'm certainly hopeful that having a better understanding of these targets will let us treat patients better and eventually have an armamentarium of drugs that can work for the individual. And that's it.
Thank you, Katie. That's terrific. Eddie?
Well,
you can repeat the questions.
Oh, sure. To repeat the question, this is a very important question. What is the role for hepatologists and gastroenterologists in the management of HCC? And I think that the emergence of active therapies thankfully, sort of reintroduces the role of an oncologist as part of a multidisciplinary team, which is certainly one of the themes of the conference thus far, in that as a medical oncologist, I certainly don't have the knowledge base and up-to-date information about antiviral therapy for my HCC patients with hepatitis B infection, and certainly require my colleagues in hepatology to help with the management of that, particularly if I'm proposing to put someone on an immunosuppressive therapy. And so we co-manage patients in that respect. There's also, bearing in mind that all of the clinical trial data that we've talked about continues to restrict eligibility largely to Child-Pugh A and Child-Pugh B7 patients. Many of our patients require aggressive management for hepatic decompensation, whether it's ascites or GI bleeding that is best managed by a hepatologist. So I think our group approach has been a very multidisciplinary one that everybody needs to be involved in. I think while patients certainly don't want to have five different appointments for any given management question, having open lines of communication and frequent tumor board conversations facilitates us taking charge of the patient together.
I think in the ideal world, you have multiple different members interested in managing HCC to see the patient on the same day. I think that would be a goal for us to accomplish. I have a question for you. What do you think is the role of mTOR inhibitor, either primary treatment or combination therapy?
So our study that I showed the missing mystery slide, which, as I assure you, looked fantastic, is a study of temsirolimus, an mTOR inhibitor, with sorafenib, and has shown provocative results so far. It's only phase 2 data, however, so I don't want to overpromise that. But everolimus, RAD001, is also in a randomized phase 3 study right now for second-line HCC, and results of that study should be available in the near future. There is certainly a provocative role for mTOR inhibitors based on the molecular understanding of the disease, with AKT upregulation in a subset of tumors playing an important role in hepatocarcinogenesis. So it stands to reason that particularly those patients may benefit from that target engagement. So post-transplant, that raises the question, if we can figure out how to identify these patients, would an mTOR-mediated immunosuppression be more appropriate? And that's certainly a topic for another discussion.
Great. Very exciting work that you're involved in. I have trouble pronouncing most of the, the drugs beyond sorafenib. So, great. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.